Hey, welcome to Servcast, and we're going to be recording today with Jeremy Isaacs. Jeremy, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right, so you might hear this differently because Jeremy's not sitting in front of me. He's actually, we're doing kind of audio over the airwaves. And what's happening where you're at? Is it raining somewhere down in Georgia, buddy?
It is raining like crazy right now. I saw something on Facebook earlier this morning. Somebody had posted that said that Noah would be swinging by to pick the rest of us up here in New York just in a few more hours. But man, it is raining like crazy right now.
Yeah, I saw something the other day on a Facebook marketplace, right, which had a similar idea. Somebody had an ark they were trying to sell, Noah's Ark. It was legitimate. It wasn't a really ark, but it was kind of funny. It was a picture and a full description. They said it only been used once, you know. So
that's crazy. Yeah, it's I don't know what's going on, but man, we're catching a lot of rain this week to 10 days while we're in the middle of it right now.
That's all good, man. We're thankful for it as it comes, you know. So
that's right.
Hey guys, those of you that are listening to us today, Jeremy Isaacs is our friend. He's a graduate of Lee University, but his real claim to fame, aside from being a pastor and an author and, you know, all that cool stuff about people, is he is a husband to his bride and the daddy of four children, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Keeps life interesting. We've got three boys, three sons, and then we've got a little girl. She's the fourth and the rose among the thorns. You know, we get people all the time that say, well, did you keep trying till you got a girl? And no, that's not what happened. We had always said we kind of wanted four kids. And it just so happened that the Lord graced us with the little girl as the fourth, kind of bookended the end of the process there. But yeah, so that's definitely my claim to fame. Anytime now, my two oldest are in middle school, and my oldest will start high school later this year. And anytime they're sitting in our service and I'm preaching and I use a story about our family or I mention one of the kids, you know, they think that's the coolest thing in the world if I mention them. And for me, I'm not really sure I had anything to preach about till I had kids. So.
That's funny. Well, you know, my wife and I, we celebrate 31 years this year, 2019. We have three sons, three daughter-in-laws. And of course, Jeremy, I got to say it, man. I'm a brand new grandpa, man.
That's incredible.
They call me Papa. Or, well, she hasn't called me anything yet. She's only 4 months old, Everly. But someday I hope she'll say, "Hey, Papa, what's up?"
So you just keep speaking it into her ear, and so that's what she'll say when she gets ready to say something. You get to plant what in her brain what you want her to call you. That's great. I love it.
You got it. But you know, I've been saying to her, "Papa loves you," and then my daughter-in-laws are like, "That's going to be Everly's first words. Papa loves you. Papa loves you." And I'm like, I don't care what she says as long as she says Papa. So
that's great. I love it. But, I love it.
Hey, let's dig into this conversation. And you know, I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join with us. But we don't really want to reiterate the entire chapel that you did recently, which was a fantastic word that you delivered at the spring convocation at Lee University. We're actually going to link that, so anybody who wants to go watch that video, they can watch it, and we'll connect all of that together. But you come from a family of ministers and from, you know, a history of kind of growing up in the ministry yourself. And so can you answer a question right out the gate for us today and talk about this whole idea of being called to ministry? What does it look like when God called you into this this preaching ministry that you're doing? How did you know God was calling you? What did that look like? And how did you know to trust him enough to respond to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I have a very unique heritage and legacy in life and in faith, and I recognize that. And I know not everybody has the same legacy that I have and the same story that I have, faith story that I have. But I come from a long line of ministers for sure. All of my grandparents, even into my great grandparents, all of my aunts and uncles are in active ministry somewhere. Many of them in pastoral ministry in a local church setting. My brother, my only brother, he's a pastor in Kentucky. And so, man, when we were growing up, it was almost like, and I don't say this to make light of it, I don't even say it really to be funny, but it was almost like ministry and pastoring was the family business. You know, if you come from a line of car salesmen, or you come from a lot of, you know, of fashion designers, or you come from a line of bankers, or you, like, it's almost like that's what we did. Everybody in our family kind of entered into ministry. And so, you know, I remember being 8, 9, 10 years old, and we would travel with my mom and my dad would preach. But before he got up to preach, we would stand and sing as a family. And, you know, we'd go to a different church every Sunday morning, then a different church every Sunday night, and usually a different church on Wednesday nights, and traveled because of the ministry that they were a part of when I was a child. And I remember these well-intended folks saying, "Oh, you're going to grow up to be a preacher like your dad." And there was a part of that, I think, that was, you know, a sense of pride, like, "Oh yeah, I love what my dad did." And my dad was my pastor, you know, all of my childhood, kind of growing up until we got really plugged into a local church when I was a little bit older into my teen years because of his job changing, changing roles. But there was also this sense of like, I don't want to call it like a bristling in my soul, but it was almost like, no, I'm going to chart my own course. I'm going to do my own thing. And so even though I would never classify my teen years or even into my college career as running from God, I definitely had sensed the call of God specific to me. And I'll explain even what I mean by that in a minute. But I'd felt that as a, you know, kind of an early teenager, maybe 13, 14, 15 years old in some different ways. But there was this sense in my heart, like, no, I don't want to just do that because everybody in my family does that. I want to do my own thing. Mm. And so I had some passions and, you know, things about law and government. And I love to read and write about politics and history. And so all those things were interest to me. And so when I was going to go to college, I decided that I was going to do some undergraduate program that would prepare me for law school. And so when I went to Lee University, I was going to be what was at that point just kind of a pre-law emphasis. There was some poli-sci stuff. There was some history. There were some other, you know, things that you could kind of use as a pre-law emphasis undergrad. But really what happened is I was sitting in a chapel service, a Sunday night chapel service. And I was sitting in the balcony of the Conn Center at Lee University. And the story that I tell is I was actually working on homework for an assignment that was due the next morning, and I was not paying attention. And whoever was preaching that night, I've tried to rack my brain. I can't remember who was preaching or what they preached on. But there was a moment towards the end of that sermon where I just kind of looked up towards the stage. I was not writing at that point. I just looked up towards the stage. And in that moment, God just got my attention. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the altar call was for. The joke that I've told for years and years is he could have called for pregnant, unwed mothers. But when he opened the altar, I knew that I had to go pray. And I got out of the balcony. I walked down to the front of the Conn Center. I knelt to the right side of the stage, just by that little stairwell. I actually found the spot again the other night. And I said to the Lord a very simple prayer. I said, God, whatever it is you want me to do, wherever it is you want me to go, I'm in. Mm. And that was pretty much the extent of the prayer. And so when I think about that, the next morning I went and changed my major and decided to pursue, you know, ministry. And what I had always felt as a call to ministry was this indescribable burden to really help people grow closer to God. Mm-hmm. And I know that plays a little different role in a lot of other people, and they may describe it as something different, but it's what I'm even, you know, I even described to my kids, or when I was in student ministry for about 10 years, me and my wife, you know, you'd have kids that would say, well, how do you know when the person you're dating is the person you're supposed to marry? And you almost give them that cliche line, well, you'll just know. There was this sense in my heart that I could not get away from, even as I was kind of running from that call, that I was created, I was called, I was compelled beyond myself to help people grow in a relationship with God. And that's what I never could shake. Right. And so even as I was thinking about law or thinking about it, it was really about helping people. So it came out of that same heart and that same desire. Right. But I wanted to help people draw closer to God. And that's really where I changed my course of my life and have never looked back. And I'm so thankful for that.
So, okay. So tell me this then, you know, Jeremy, I grew up, my dad was a pastor, you know, for 52 years of his life before he went on to heaven. And, you know, I'm the youngest of seven, and there's only two of us out of the seven that are in the ministry as far as like a preaching, teaching ministry is considered. So for those people who have a rich ministerial heritage, but yet they are not called to do what you and I are called to do in pulpits, right, and teaching stages around the world, how do they avoid the trap of being called by their heritage? You know, what was real? You say, okay, well, I knew what I know. My dad always said this, Jeremy, I know in my knower, you know,
that's right.
Down
that's
in right. The depths of my soul, I have no question mark, you know, but how do you help these people that are, you know, maybe they aspire to ministry, but they really aren't called to do that. You know, maybe they're called to do something differently. What's your advice to them to be able to identify this as a heavenly creator's call, Jehovah's call on my life to preach the gospel, not my dad or my mom's ministerial heritage?
I'll try to answer it in two ways. One, I had to really flesh that out for myself. And what's so funny is my dad had a similar story. I didn't really know that whole story until I was older and had experienced it and walked through it myself, because he was careful to share that story in a way that it wouldn't kind of change what I was pursuing personally. But my dad went to Lee University for 1 year. And he left Lee and really went out to Colorado. He had his grandparents lived out there. His parents were pastors in North Carolina. And he went to Colorado to really get away and discover the ministry heart for himself. Mm. And he traveled around evangelizing, preaching in churches. And he came back from that that season of time in Colorado back to North Carolina and began to do his own personal ministry there, because he didn't feel like if he left Lee and went to North Carolina, he would ever get beyond just being his parents' names are YZ and Judy. He would never get out from being just YZ and Judy's son in ministry, but he became Bill because he got to do ministry a little bit away from his comfort. You know, there's no honor in Prophet's hometown. So he went and did something else. For me, I had to do that as well. After I changed my major, I went and did a ministry internship a couple hours away from where my family was at and got plugged into a local church to really see, do I have a heart for ministry, or is this just something I'm comfortable with? You know, Jesus called the disciples. This is kind of the second way I'd even answer it. Jesus called those disciples, and he kind of called them out of their fishing boats, or he called them out of their tax collecting. And so he walked around with them for 3 years. But then once Jesus left, what did they do? They went back to fishing. Like, they just kind of went back to their default mode. They went back to what they were comfortable with. So there are probably people that have a heritage and a legacy of ministry that probably could do ministry. But the way I've always heard it described is, don't do ministry because it's something you can do. Mm. Only do ministry if it's something you absolutely have to do.
Right.
Like, there's nothing else in life that would fulfill me. There's nothing else in life that would help me to find the satisfaction to know that I am in my God-ordained calling and purpose. And so, you know, I think you find a place to plug in and do ministry in some setting. And if you just don't feel like this is absolutely what God's calling me to do, but it's something I could do, then you explore some other avenues and see if there's something else God can specifically do through you.
Right. A friend of mine defined it this way. He said, if you can run away from it, you're not called.
That's right. That's right.
If you can get away from it, you're not called. And so, okay, let's talk about this journey, because, you know, for those of us that are called into ministry, you know, there's going to be roadblocks. There's going to be rumble strips. You know, you communicated that term some time ago. And so what are some roadblocks or difficulties or challenges that you've had to kind of endure along this journey? And how will you encourage other listeners to be able to recognize that these bumps in the road, these explosions, these bombs, you know, all these situations that happen in life, you know, really they don't have to set us aside if we're willing to endure through the journey. Any advice on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, for people that are trying to figure out if they are called to ministry, or people that are in ministry and they don't have the same legacy or heritage that we've been talking about here, they're a first generation faith story, or maybe they're a first generation ministry story. You know, maybe theirs is trying to figure out, how do they navigate this and what seems like on their own? How do they navigate this without having some of those same, you know, people to lean on, or, you know, that, or on the flip side, maybe you have somebody like me or even like you that kind of grew up in it or around it. And so I think ultimately for every person in ministry, one of those roadblocks is trying to discover your unique callings and giftings. Mm-hmm. You know, I think early on, most of the preachers that I know, myself included, we sounded a lot like our favorite preacher or teacher or our former pastor or our father or our childhood pastor or our youth pastor, or, you know, whoever those greatest influences were in our lives. And I don't think that's bad. I think we have to discover our voice by discovering what our voice is not. And so when I tried to preach like somebody else, for me, early in my ministry, there were a couple of those voices. My dad was definitely one of those. But another voice early kind of in my ministry, maybe not right at the beginning, was Louis Giglio, who kind of is the founder and father of the Passion Movement. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, that was an exploding kind of ministry nationwide and really worldwide. And I'd gone to some of their conferences and been a part of the local church ministry in the Atlanta area that he had at that time called 722. And he was this phenomenal storyteller. And I had to learn how to communicate the gospel in a way that was, you know, kind of connected to my own giftings, because I couldn't tell stories like Louis Giglio. Wow. I couldn't weave together a narrative like he could. So mine always felt like it was a little bit lacking. So one of those roadblocks, or one of those kind of things that you got to really figure out, is you got to figure out who you are. And I've got a young minister on my staff right now. And I told him the only way you really discover that is by figuring out who you're not. Mm-hmm. You got to figure out where, you know, a strength is not just something you're good at. I think a strength is what makes you feel strong. Mm-hmm. And so I think the idea here is I've got to be doing enough things in ministry and getting enough practical experience that I get done with that and I go, hey, it wasn't the best, but man, I felt strong there. I felt like God was with me. I felt like I had, you know, I was in my unique space that God. And so you got to kind of be in those environments so that you can walk off a stage or walk out of an environment and go, man, I don't feel gifted for that. I don't feel equipped for that. I don't feel called to that. And then, you know, okay, well, then I'm going to lay that down and let somebody else pick that up and embody that part of the body of Christ. So one of those for me, kind of long answer to a short question, one of those is finding that unique calling. I think another one of those is balancing the tension between loving people, serving people, caring for people, having a heart for people, but not finding your identity or success in people. You know, I just think there's such a balancing act there, because we care for people, we love people. If you're a minister worth your salt, you want to help people take next steps and grow in relationship with Christ. But then I also think if we're not careful, their words of affirmation or their words of criticism become our definition of success. Mm-hmm. When we walk off a stage from preaching, when they tell us that's the greatest sermon I've ever heard, then we feel like the greatest preacher that's ever preached. But when they, you know, maybe say, it was okay, or if they say something else, if it's even more critical, then we feel like we haven't done what we're supposed to do. And really, all we're called to do is be faithful. God is called to be fruitful. Mm-hmm. And so I'm only accountable for my level of faithfulness to the calling and to the environment that God is calling me into. And then ultimately, I allow God to bear the fruit out from my faithfulness and really what he can accomplish. And so I've got to constantly balance that. And I've been guilty of that. I've allowed myself to feel like a failure when people left our ministry or walked away from our church. I've allowed myself to feel like a humongous success when things were kind of up and to the right. All the numbers were moving. And I don't know that I'm a better pastor if it's just one of those days where a lot more people decide to come to church than I am on a Sunday where maybe more people go to the lake because the weather's good. That doesn't make me a worse pastor. So I've got to not find my measure of success in the numbers or the people, and I've got to just be faithful to the calling that God has placed on my life. Those are two that just jump right out to me. There's plenty of others, but just a couple that I think are important.
Sure. Let's unpack a statement that you made just a moment ago. We got about 3 or 4 minutes left in this particular segment. We'll take a break and we'll be right back. But before that break, I want you to kind of dive into this for just a minute. You said that we're called to be faithful and it's God's responsibility to be fruitful, right?
That's right.
What does that really look like in a practical sense? Because somehow we tend to equate this idea of busyness as success. That's not always true. So how do we know when we're trying to be involved in the fruitful stuff and we really just need to get right back involved in the faithful stuff? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think for me, I am always aware, even if I don't acknowledge it publicly, I'm always aware on the private side and the heart side about how faithful I've been to what I've been, you know, given to do in a moment, whether that's the preparation for preaching, whether that's the preparation for a staff meeting, whether that's the amount of compassion that I give to someone who's hurting in a moment. I'm aware of if I'm truly invested and faithful to the moment of ministry that's in front of me, or if I'm just kind of going through the motions. And so what I mean is, you know, there's this sense of, and I am one of the biggest proponents of it, that we have this spirit of excellence. Well, I think my definition of excellence has shifted a little bit over the years. It's not that we do the absolute best. I think excellence is doing the best with what you have available to you. Mm-hmm. And so I think that looks a lot different for a lot of different people. For a pastor or minister that's in a very small rural town, you know, population, a certain number, they may never have the kind of growth numbers or attendance percentage increase or the number of first-time guests that a brand-new church planter in an urban inner-city type of environment may have. But both of those ministers are still called to a level of faithfulness that says, to the absolute best that I can, have I been faithful and honest with what God has entrusted into my hand? Have I been a good steward of that? And then allow God to do what only God can do in the lives of the people that are entrusted to our ministry. I just believe that for so many of us, if we're not careful, we think we make fruit. Yep. And we don't make fruit. We're just called to be connected to the vine and to stay connected to God. And he's the one that when we do that, he's the one that bears fruit. And ultimately in my life, there's been a lot of seasons where I've tried to make fruit. And that's not what I'm called to do. I'm just called to stay connected to the vine, be faithful, be a good steward, and allow God to do what only he can do.
Hey guys, we'll be right back with our second episode, with our second segment of this episode with Jeremy Isaacs. Hey, and we're back with this conversation with Pastor Jeremy Isaacs. Jeremy, so this book, let's talk about this book that you and your brother Jason wrote. It's called Toxic Soul, correct?
Correct.
Tell me something. Why in the world this book? What's the motivation behind this book, Toxic Soul? And why is that the title that you chose?
Yeah, you know, it's the kind of the subtitle, the working subtitle we had all along that we actually ended up sticking with as we released the book was A Pastor's Guide to Leading Without Losing Heart.
Okay.
You know, I mentioned our family heritage. My brother and I both, we grew up in a minister's home, pastor's home. My dad and mom, their role in ministry, they were local church pastors when we were much younger, but then they transitioned into a denominational administrative role. And because of that, like I said, we traveled around and we were in a different church. Just about every time the doors were open to church, we were in a different church. And we, you know, led youth camps and different events statewide, denominationally, and regionally, and that kind of thing. And so we estimated, I think we put this in the introduction of the book, we estimated we've probably met more than 10,000 pastors in our lives, probably more than that, but we were trying to be conservative. And so because of that, we felt like there were some really common struggles that most pastors have. And those struggles, so often when we're in the middle of them ourselves, we think that we're unique in that. We think we're the only ones worried about those things. But the commonality of those struggles really sometimes lead us to a place of kind of being toxic in our soul, being toxic in our heart, allowing relationships in our lives to become toxic, and really losing sight of who God is uniquely to us. And so we talk about, you know, some things like results. You know, we talk about numbers, which you and I were just talking about a few minutes ago, but, you know, the numbers and the dreams that we have in our lives and in our ministry, and how do we play those things out in a way that's healthy, but not in such a way that it becomes our definition of success. We talk about, you know, the realities of teamwork and the realities of criticism and the realities of, you know, vision and budgets and all those kind of things. And then we talk about the idea of relationships, you know, where healthy relationships are supposed to play a role in our life, and what other relationships we may need to step away from in different seasons. And we felt like that those three areas of results, realities, and relationships really kind of brought together the common struggles that so many pastors we had met, and then us as fellow sojourners and practitioners in local church pastoring and ministry. It's things we've struggled with on a regular basis. And so we took a couple of group text messages with some pastor friends of ours, and we said, hey, what are some things you struggle with? What are some things that you're wrestling with, before we ever started writing? And they sent us back a humongous list of things, and we kind of pulled those into some categories, and we felt like there was so much overlap around these three categories and really the 10 issues that we wrote about in the book, that we felt like it was important to really get this out to pastors and ministers.
So define the word toxic for us at this point. What does it actually mean? And what does it mean to have a toxic soul?
Yeah, I think the idea of being toxic is it's a little bit beyond that place of unhealth. It's the place where, you know, unhealth breeds into something detrimental. It's not just that I'm a little bit sick, I've got a little bit of a cough. It becomes something that begins to get into every area, every relationship, every interaction, every place of ministry. And so the idea of a toxic soul is one that we kind of lose our sense of who we are. We lose our soul that you know, the scripture tells us in the New Testament that God jealously desires the soul, the spirit that he placed within us. And so because of that, you know, we felt like if you lose your soul, if your soul becomes toxic, it becomes even beyond just a little bit unhealthy, then you've lost your ability to fully and healthily do the ministry that God's uniquely called you to do. And so for us, it was just about identifying those things that lead us towards that place, or if we are there, how do we kind of come back from them? How do we find more places of health and healing in our heart and in our lives as we move beyond just identifying it?
So let's talk about that identification. Are there particular indicators that a person would be able to recognize that they're becoming toxic in their soul? A lot of times it's easier for me to identify that you're toxic than for you to identify that you're toxic, right? And so what are some indicators that we need to be aware of, both individually, to make sure that we do not become sour in our own journey of faith, and also maybe some indicators that we would be able to use in helping keep our fellow sojourners accountable in the process as well?
Yeah, I think one of the greatest identifiers of a toxic soul, in ministry especially, is when we begin to view ourselves as the one that does the life change. And here's what I mean. The definitions that we would have of success, which we talked about a few minutes ago, when they become the metric that we kind of overlay to everything, the numbers, the salvations, the baptisms, the attendance, the giving, you know, the nickels and the noses, all those kind of things. If we put that on our effort and we put that on our ability to create that and sustain that, we run the risk of either currently being toxic or leading ourselves towards, you know, being toxic. Because I think if we're not careful, we become the God of our own ministry. We become the God of the work of ministry rather than viewing God to do the work that only he can do. And so, you know, in the introduction of the book, my brother describes a scene around Christmas. It was at my house, and we do a unique gift exchange as a part of the larger Christmas gifts exchange, where we do this every year. We draw names and we give what we call a spiritual gift. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be a Bible or a devotional or, you know, that kind of thing, but it has to have some spiritual significance, and you have to give it to the person that you draw their name, and you have to tell them why you were giving them that gift. And so Jason's introduction, his portion of the introduction to the book, he writes about that Christmas evening when my wife gave him a golf shirt. And as she was handing him that golf shirt, he's an avid golfer. He's a very good golfer. She said, you know, I think you're so confident on the golf course. You have a lot of confidence about your ability. You don't doubt yourself. She said, but over the last year or two, I've really watched in ministry how you've begun to doubt yourself and doubt your ability and doubt your ability to be a good pastor. And she said, I would just really love for you to take that confidence that you have in other areas of life and really bring that back into your ministry life. And so Jason opened up his journal that night after we had gotten done and all the kids went to bed. He opened up his journal and he wrote in the first page of that journal, "This is the year I get my mojo back."
Yeah.
And it really was about the transition of seeing himself not as the one who defines success and failure in ministry, and really an utter dependence on God to do the work of ministry in and through him, that he was going to be as faithful as he could be and trust God for all the rest. For me, in the introduction, where I felt like I was in kind of leaning towards that toxic place, was really what I classified as the time I almost burned out. And it really came from not a lack of, you know, healthy ministry, but it really came from a lack of priorities and prioritization in my life. My mom had passed away. I had really thrown myself into the 2-year journey where she battled with cancer. I laid most of the priorities of my life aside for those 2 years, even from a distance, as I tried to care for her, be a distant caregiver, be a sounding board for my dad. I never really dealt with my own pain, my own hurt. And after she passed away, I had thrown myself back into really playing catch up from those 2 years. And we were having dinner one night at our house. My wife had made dinner. We were eating in the living room on TV trays, watching a TV show together with our family. And I got up, walked into the kitchen to grab a fork. And as I walked back in, the whole world started spinning. I thought I was having a heart attack. Eventually, I laid down on the couch and wept for about 3 or 4 hours. And I was having, you know, a panic attack or an anxiety attack or whatever you want to call it. But the unhealth of suppressing the emotions and feelings of my life that I'd buried deep inside of me, they just had to find a way out. And so I talk about, you know, for some people, that's a result of emotional trauma. For some people, that's a result of sin and hidden sin. For some people, that's a result of unsuccessful ministry, or it's a result of unsuccess or a lack of success in their marriage or their life or their family or business or finance, whatever that is. But they begin to suppress it and push it down. But eventually, it's going to make its way out. There was some toxicity that had gotten down in my heart and in my soul that I'd never really dealt with and never really vented those things out in healthy ways, and they had to come out. And so we just talk about, you know, finding those places where you feel like the pressure's boiling, or you feel like you're lingering or bordering on a line of depression, or you're bordering on a line of anxiety and fear, and doubt creeps in beyond just what we would classify as normal, just worry. And when you feel those things, you hear those warning signs, you hear your language where you begin to start making excuses for a lack of results. You hear yourself start to fudge the truth in certain areas of your life. You see yourself start to compromise even in little small areas. You're bordering on becoming toxic because now you are compromising who you truly are, and your soul is at risk. And that's really the way that we would define it. And that's how we then got to dive into some of these specific issues that we believe begin to take root in our hearts and in our lives.
Yeah. And you just laid a picture out for all of us to be able to identify that. Fortunately, in this situation, you know, you have a supporting spouse, you have a supporting family, and you are also a supporting member of that family for your brother and other members of the family. What about those persons that let's speak to the pastor for just a minute, Jeremy, who doesn't feel like he has a supporting family, doesn't feel like he has a supporting mate, and has pretty much become very toxic in his own soul. What's next? Nobody wants to crash and burn. I mean, literally, who wants to crash and burn? Nobody does, right? But for those people who might have already find themselves on the downhill spiral, man, what do you say to them today? What kind of hope can you provide for that particular listener who might be thinking, you know, there's just no way out of here?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the translations of Proverbs 18:24 says, a man who has friends must show himself friendly. You know, the second part of that verse is where it talks about that there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And depending on your translation, the first portion of that may not be translated the same way I just quoted it. But I believe it's the New King James that talks about a man who has friends must show himself friendly. And I've always read that, and I've always used that in my own life, that I cannot look for other people to do for me what I won't do for myself. And here's what I mean. I can't look to other people to befriend me if I'm not willing to be that kind of friend I'm looking for. So if I say, hey, I don't have a friendship network, a support network, if I don't have a spouse that's, you know, willing to hear me out or to help walk this journey with me, then I've got to go find those relationships. I can't just sit in Starbucks by myself and wait on someone to come and seek me out. I've got to go seeking those relationships out. I've got to make myself a little uncomfortable. I've got to make myself a little, you know, awkward even. I've got to do some things that might not be natural to me, and I got to pick up the phone. I've got to call somebody. I've got to, you know, find a local ministerial fellowship. I've got to call the youth pastor across town. I've really got to seek those relationships out. And it's just like anything else. The first one or two may not stick, but I believe that if we'll seek that out, it is so vitally important not to do life and not to do ministry alone, that I believe it's worth the effort. You know, I've said for a long time that, you know, one of the greatest tools of the enemy, and he's only got a few, is that he would try to isolate us. He would try to get us to a place where we don't feel like there's anybody we can talk to, anybody we can, you know, entrust those secret places of our lives and our hearts. And not everybody needs to know your junk, but somebody needs to know your junk.
Right.
And so I just think there's some, we've got to lean into those relationships. We've got to find those relationships where people can, you know, we can trust people with the places of our heart and our life that we're wrestling with, that we're struggling with, and that have maybe common struggles. I think there's just something that unlocks in us when somebody hears us be a little bit vulnerable and say, here's what I'm wrestling with. Here's where I'm doubting myself. Here's what I'm feeling. Here's where I'm frustrated. Here's what I'm scared of. And to hear them say, I've felt that way too. Mm-hmm. It is a key that unlocks something in our heart and in our souls that it can't be really described by anything other than just a supernatural moment to go, wow, there's someone who's in a similar journey that I'm in. There's that commonality of the human experience and the ministry experience that I think is vitally important. And honestly, I think I heard somebody say a long time ago that everybody needs a coach and everybody needs someone to coach. Mm-hmm. So I know we're not talking about coaching, but really that idea that someone who's outside of our perspective that can speak into those places of our lives. And like you said a minute ago, maybe somebody that can identify, hey, there's some toxic soul markers present in your life. There's some things that I see that need to be corrected. If the best athletes in the world need a coach, then I probably need a ministry coach. I need a relationship coach. Maybe it's counseling. Maybe it's consulting. Maybe it's just a friend. But I need that outside perspective that can kind of walk this journey with me. And I just think it's vitally important. I think it's a non-negotiable in life and in ministry.
Right. And usually a good coach is one who has learned how to journey through a challenge themselves. You know,
that's
and
right.
They were able to get through the challenge. So let's get very personal with you for just a minute. And let's talk about a challenge that you recently had to go through, you know, ratings on books and ratings on podcasts. I mean, ratings is what causes people to listen or to think, I'm going to trust this book. I'm going to trust this podcast. I'm going to spend my energy and my time on that. You recently got a 1-star rating on Amazon with regard to the book. Is that correct?
That's right. That's
Nobody
right.
wants a 1-star rating, right? I mean, everybody That's wants right. a 5 and above, correct?
That's right. Yeah. That's
so,
exactly.
And you wrote a blog about it. So talk to us about, how does it feel to get a 1-star? You know, what did that do for you or to you? And how did you respond to that? And all right, coach, it's your turn. Teach us how to get through that journey.
Well, I think, you know, not long after we wrote the book, we had a number of people that were responding to us. And I say this honestly with as much humility as I possibly can. I don't mean this braggadociously or anything. We got a lot of feedback early on and then even over these last few weeks and months still where, you know, a pastor would say, like, this book literally saved my marriage. It saved my ministry. We've had tons and tons of great reviews currently on Amazon. When I wrote the blog a while back, we had a 4.8 out of 5 stars, like just great response from the people that had read it. but my eyes tended to linger on that one-star review where I assume a guy, just based on some of the verbiage that they use, but maybe a lady as well here that wrote it, just said, hey, I didn't love the book. I just didn't like, you know, I didn't like this portion. This is what the author said, and this is what I felt like they did, and I don't feel like that they followed through on what they said they were writing about. Well, not too long after that, as I was kind of reading that and thinking about that and processing that, someone left a one-star Google review for our church, and I was made aware of it. And about that same time, not too long after I'd been at convocation to speak, somebody got on Facebook and very directly attacked me and my motives and my integrity and my heart and our church. And as I read those things, I began to think about, why do these things bother me so much? And I really started to kind of get into my heart level, and I've got some people around me that have permission to speak into my life and, you know, tell me sometimes when I'm being an idiot. And so there were, I was saying things or questioning things or asking things. And here's what I really came down to. For me, the one-star reviews or the comments on Facebook or the one-star review about the church, it's not that I wanted to talk to those people to change their mind. I very much believe they have the right to think and feel what they think and feel. I've rated things as one or two stars before. I know what a bad experience or not meeting expectations looks like. So I get that. But my desire was to respond to them because I wanted to explain myself. Mm-hmm. I wanted to explain to them why we included the portions of the book that they didn't care for. Right. I wanted to explain to the person that left the review for our church, you know, why that might be a misunderstanding about it. I wanted to explain to the guy on Facebook who had never been to our church and didn't know me personally what they were misunderstanding about me. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't that I wanted to change their mind per se, though that probably was a part of me wanting to have that conversation, but it really was, I didn't want to be misunderstood. I wanted to be able to explain my heart and my motive. And then if they still felt the way they felt, then hey, more power to them. And so I think for me, my response was I lost focus. And what I did is instead of focusing on all the 4- and 5-star reviews of the book, instead of focusing on the literally hundreds of people that are, their lives are being impacted and changed as a part of the ministries of our church, instead of focusing on the incredible opportunity to speak at convocation or other ministry opportunities that happened around that same season of time of ministry for me, I was not focusing on the blessings and the benefit and the fruit of the ministry in that season. I was focusing on the 1 or 2 naysayers. And in losing focus, I got distracted. Mm-hmm. And then if I'm not careful what I would do, and I'm not saying this is what happened in that season, but I think some voices around me were saying to me, like, if you're not careful, you will begin doing ministry to speak to the naysayers. Mm-hmm. You'll become very defensive. You'll begin to deflect. You'll become very antagonistic, and you'll speak to the haters versus acknowledging the people who are on your side. They love you. They're in support of you. And this is not about, you know, feeling good about yourself or somebody to pat you on the back. I even put in the blog post when I wrote it, this is not so anybody who knows me will come up to me the next time and say, you're doing a great job, we believe in you. But it's really just to acknowledge that there is a group of people, no matter how small that group may be, it may be 1 or 2, or it may be hundreds, or it may be thousands, who are on your side. They believe in you. They love what you're doing and how faithful you're being. And so don't lose focus on those people just to speak to the 1 or 2 or 3 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 even naysayers or one-star reviewers. And so for me, it was about being focused on the right things and the right group of people, right, and not losing focus and be distracted.
And I appreciate your approach too, Jeremy, because I mean, currently in North America, you know, we're living in a knee-jerk reaction kind of model where somebody doesn't like something, they just blitz it through social media, you know, and then you get another reaction and a reaction. But what you did was you responded to something, you know, instead of reacting to something. And so obviously that's an indicator of wisdom and experience over the years. But we're getting ready to close this this episode today with you. So closing thoughts as you speak to those listeners today and encourage them. Now, what we do know is we're being heard in about 17 countries and about 48 states. And so we're pretty excited about that. And we're thankful that, you know, people are listening to Servcast. But what are some last closing thoughts about our topic today that you want to share with our listeners to encourage them to make sure that they keep their souls healthy and not toxic?
Yeah, I think the key would be don't do life alone. Don't do ministry alone. You know, yes, we do have a friend that sticks closer than a brother. I think it's so important for us to remember that we have God on our side. We have God available to us. He said he would never leave us nor forsake us. But I think there's also that important piece of human relationship that is so encouraging to our lives. And so I would say to ensure that you're walking this journey with somebody that has your back, you know, that kind of the David and Jonathan, that, that somebody that's protecting you, that defends you, that loves you, that cares for you on a soul level. I think when you have that kind of relationship, I think it's Pastor Greg Surratt, who's a part of the leadership of the Association of Related Churches, the church planting organization. He says that you need a group of people who love you but aren't impressed by you. Mm. And what that looks like is it's people that are willing to say the hard things to you. They love you so much that they're willing to tell you when you're being an idiot. They're willing to tell you when you've made mistakes. They're willing to call you to the carpet when you need to make adjustments in the way that you're living. And they're not impressed by you. They're not impressed by your titles. They're not impressed by the things that you've accomplished in your life. They really do love you so much that they want to help you be the best that you can be. Mm-hmm. And so I think the relationships in life and in ministry are so vitally important that you've got to be the kind of friend you're looking for. And so even if you don't look around your life right now and see that you have a ton of that, make the phone call, walk up and have the conversation with the person you see across the coffee shop or across the way, call the pastor or the other ministry leader in your town and just do a cold call and ask them if you can take them to lunch or breakfast or coffee or send them a gift, bribe them if you have to, but find a way to do ministry and life with at least one other, but a group of other people so that you can be all that God has called you and created you to be. And so that the enemy cannot try to isolate you to the place that you don't feel like you've got anybody that can relate to what's going on in your life. And I just think that's so vitally important that I would tell you it's a non-negotiable. And so if you don't have it, seek it out.
Awesome. Hey, if somebody wants to reach out to you, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, all of the social media stuff that I'm on, it's just Jeremy Isaacs, ISAACS. And then they can find me on my blog at jeremyisaacs.org. So I'd love to connect and to help any way I can.
Fantastic. Hey, guys, remember, as always on Servcast, I want to encourage you that you're made for more. God created you and put you into this place in this world of chaos to make a difference in somebody else's life, and we'd like to encourage you to do that. And thanks again for listening to Servcast, and we'll catch you next time. Take care.